This is the audio from a recent Institute of Economic Affairs YouTube video. We've stripped the audio so that you can listen on the go.
The Roman Empire is an extractive entity. Those people are living in the cities not simply or entirely because of economic production. They are doing so in part because of the coercive apparatus of the Roman state.
Hello and welcome to the Institute of Economic Affairs YouTube channel. I'm Daniel Freeman, Managing Editor here at the IEA. If man were called to fix the period in the history of the world during which the condition of the human race was most happy and prosperous, he would, without hesitation, name that which elapsed from the death of Domitian to the accession of Commodus. The vast extent of the Roman Empire was governed by absolute power, under the guidance of virtue and wisdom. The armies were restrained by the firm but gentle hand of four successive emperors, whose characters and authority commanded involuntary respect. These are the words of the great historian Edward Gibbon, which he used to describe the Roman Empire at the height of its power in the 2nd century AD. But just how secure was this prosperity really? Today, we'll be discussing the economics of Rome's golden age and hopefully uncovering both its strengths and its vulnerabilities. To do this, I'm delighted to be joined down the line by Colin Elliott. Colin is an associate professor of history at Indiana University, specializing in economics and epidemiology in ancient Rome. Along with publishing countless articles, he's also the host of the Pax Romana podcast, which I really recommend if you want a good narrative introduction to the Roman Empire from the reign of Augustus through to the end of the second century. He is also the author of two books, the latest of which is Pax Romana, The Plague Which Shook the Roman World, which is a really interesting and well-written account of the Antonine Plague, which devastated Rome in the 160s and is in bookshops now. So, Colin, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for that generous introduction and very, very kind words about the book and the podcast.
No, it's I really enjoyed reading it. And the podcast is excellent as well. So I wanted to start off just at quite a broad basis. How was the Roman economy in, say, the year 150 AD different from, say, a modern industrial economy like Britain or the US?
Yeah. Great question. So the Roman economy is in some ways a product of the Roman Empire, and that obviously, but in the more complicated sense, the Roman Empire is an extractive entity that is interested in consuming the resources that are produced in the provinces and in the cities. And so what that means is, on the one hand, Roman emperors do want to see a prosperous economy, but insofar as it is then possible for them to use those resources on the things that they are most interested in, which is largely the military and essentially additional conquest. Now, by the time we get to the mid-second century, the period of conquest is largely over, even if the Romans aren't quite willing to admit that yet. And there is a period of consolidation and essentially building a commonwealth. And so a lot of the consumption of the resources that are produced in the Roman economy go towards beautification, the spreading of Greek culture and Hellenistic culture, building a variety of just cultural and architectural wonders, and essentially creating a kind of unified system. And that economic system essentially burns through a lot of the productive capacity of the Roman Empire. So there's this great flourishing in the middle of the second century, but it is far more consumptive than it is sort of producing capital, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point, which you bring out quite a lot in the book, that when we think of ancient Rome, we often think in terms of cities and, you know, the great monumental architecture. But as you point out, the vast majority of the population don't live in cities. Do we have any sense for the numbers that are living in cities relative to in the countryside?
Yeah, that's a great question. And scholars differ a little bit on where we might put, say, a percentage figure. We don't have these statistics or the census information to give a precise figure, but scholars tend to fall between about 10 and 20% of an urbanization rate in the Roman Empire, which that is in one sense very impressive for a pre-industrial empire. There's no doubt about it. To have that many people able to live off the surplus, off the wealth that is produced. I mean, these are people that are often not in the fields, or at least not full-time in the fields. And so, you know, this is quite impressive. But on the other hand, and yeah, as you rightly mentioned, this is something that I point out in the book, those people are living in the cities not simply or entirely because of economic production. They are doing so in part because of the coercive apparatus of the Roman state. From the late Republic onward, both the city of Rome, but then also many of the satellite cities of the Roman Empire are interested in feeding the urban population and providing for them as a marker of status, in a way to distinguish the privilege of living in a city as opposed to living in the countryside. And so there are tremendous economic incentives to move to the cities so that one can consume these resources. And of course, as a consequence, the resources that the countryside produces are then being consumed in the cities and are moved there by means of a coercive state apparatus. So it's a little bit deceptive. It's, of course, spectacular that this many people live in the cities, but it could give us the wrong impression if we assume that cities in the Roman Empire are similar to, say, the productive cities that we see around the time of the Industrial Revolution.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting point, because we often think of cities and urbanization rates as a sort of synonym for economic development. Because, you know, in Britain in the Industrial Revolution, we did get this process of people moving into cities because these are productive centers. And this is indicative of a growing economy. But what you seem to be saying is that cities in the Roman Empire are essentially welfare queens. They're sort of parasitical bodies, when the real wealth of the empire is being generated in the countryside. Is that going too far? Or are there some roles for, you know, actual economic roles for these cities?
Yeah, it's what you're saying is true. And yes, then I would go further. I don't want to suggest that these cities are not producing economic efflorescence. And I think that's probably a more helpful word than growth. And that is, of course, when all of these people are gathered together, they have their basic needs met, they can do the sorts of things that could not be done when people are eking out a subsistence life in the countryside. They are able to use money and create monetary systems. They are able to design complicated banking relationships and accounting systems. They're able to acquire vast tracts of land and create cash crops on the land, which is then moved into cities and marketed. And we have retailers and a variety of specialists that essentially kind of do move goods and services throughout the Roman urbanized economy. But what we just have to remember is this is more of an efflorescence. It's more of a consumptive moment in the Roman economy rather than one that sustains a kind of new threshold in which, the Roman economy reaches a level of growth and productivity that it can then build off of further. And we see the kind of hockey stick that we see in the industrial world. That just doesn't happen. And I think it's largely because despite all of the artifacts of production that we see in the city, there is not a foundational basis in which, you know, sort of we see the generation and sustaining and growth of capital, per capita growth, as being important or even maybe even understood.
Right. That, yeah, that's really interesting. So cities play a kind of crucial political role and social role in the Roman Empire, but they kind of need the support of these elites in order to sustain themselves at such a high level. What sort of things are Roman elites doing to draw people into cities, if it's not pure sort of productive reasons?
Yeah, this is a great question, because there's a few things going on. And again, some of it is economic and some of it is almost like franchising. So let me explain what I mean. First, the economic side of it. Of course, with the consumption that's occurring in the cities, largely led by elites using, again, the produce of their vast estates and vast networks, of course, this is drawing people in because elites are almost duty-bound, obligated to distribute what they have in terms of their property and wealth with the broader population. And it is an incentive for them to do so because it is a great marker of status. It gives them political advantage. So, for example, in the city of Rome, in order to rise higher and higher in the social strata and the political system of the city of Rome, one needs to have a certain minimum amount of landed wealth. And so it is to one's advantage to display that wealth and to use that wealth. Of course, if, with the patron-client system as well, if you receive from somebody, you then owe them something in return, which can often mean votes. It can mean support in other ways. So it was useful for Roman elites to consume their resources and distribute them in this way. And this, of course, drew people in, both to receive the resources, but also to engage in work on monumental building projects and baths and libraries and so on and so forth. And of course, these types of buildings and institutions are attractive in their own right. Who doesn't want to, at least in superficial terms, go to a Roman bath? As I discuss in the book, this is actually far more disgusting than we might think. But nevertheless, these are markers of status. So they draw people into the city. The other thing, though, that's going on is elites are operating like franchises of the Roman imperial state. And by that, I mean they are incentivized by the imperial system to replicate what is happening in imperial Rome. That is, they want to show their loyalty to the emperors by building monuments and providing funds that both give the local elite credit, but that also give credit to the emperor and show that the local elites are indeed loyal to the emperor and that they are willing to play ball with the Romans and sort of participate in this commonwealth building that we see happening in the second century AD. So there are economic aspects, and then there are these sort of cultural, social, economic aspects going on as well.
Yeah, that idea of franchises, sort of the central Roman state delegating to local elites the sort of responsibility for controlling urban populations with essentially what we'd now call welfare spending is a really interesting one. One really sort of significant example of this from your work, and it's talked about very widely, is this the annona, the kind of grain dole that exists in Rome and then later on in Constantinople. Could you tell us a bit more about what this is and what role it plays?
Yeah. So on the one hand, the annona system is a remarkable achievement. And what happens is, just very briefly, in the late Republic, ambitious politicians that want to both create a lot of clients for themselves and to court popular approval of their agendas begin to pass out subsidized grain and then later free grain. And this is subsidized and then paid for by the state. Now, under the Roman emperors, these programs have, of course, expanded because, as I'm sure you folks know at the IEA, once a government program is instituted, it is very difficult to get rid of it. If anything, it tends to grow. And this is what happens with the annona system. So by the time the emperors are in charge, you know, a good amount of the 1 million or so people that are in Rome are dependent in some way, at least partially, on this free grain that is coming into the city of Rome. And so it becomes crucial for Roman emperors to uphold this system, because if it collapses, there will be a food riot on their hands that is impossible to suppress. I mean, when we're talking about around a million people in the city, all of them hungry, this can get very, very dangerous. And this is witnessed in various parts of the middle to late second century. So the annona system then is largely state directed, and especially increasingly over time, from everything to, you know, the grain being extracted from these imperial estates in a select few bread baskets, especially in Egypt. This is probably the most important area in which grain is provided to the city of Rome, but then also in a few others, Sicily and North Africa. So those estates are owned by the emperor. In many cases, the state pays for grain at a fixed price or just extracts it outright in the form of taxes. When it is loaded onto ships, those are largely sort of state-organized workers and state-controlled workers. The ships that then transport the grain to Rome are these large, massive ships, which are underwritten by state insurance policies. If one is carrying grain for the state and their ship happens to crash into a rock or get sunk in a storm, the state will reimburse the value of the ship and its contents. The grain fleet is then controlled and ordered in a certain way so that it arrives at Rome at the same time. The ships must then wait at the dock until the state approves them to be unloaded, and then the workers that unload them have a kind of local monopoly on the right to unload those ships, and then they're distributed, and then the grain in those ships is distributed in the city of Rome in this kind of state managed way. So almost from seed to bread, the grain that is fed to the citizens of Rome is a product of these kind of coercive state forces. So it's dramatic and incredible to see this system operate, but it is also in some ways a system that demonstrates this extractive nature of the Roman state and shows kind of why people would go into the cities to receive produce like this. And of course, the Roman state does this as well with wine and olive oil and later even pork and other things. So you can see why this is such an interesting system.
Yeah, that was one of the things I found really interesting about how it sort of expands from starting out as subsidized grain for bread, and then it becomes free grain, and then it ends up being olive oil, pork, and wine, because, you know, the prospect of spending a night sober was viewed similarly by the ancient Romans as death by starvation. So, but that aspect of how heavily the state was involved in every stage of this supply chain, I found really interesting, because I've sometimes heard it suggest in sort of, you know, by other scholars that this was, okay, the Romans did have this welfare system, but it was essentially, it was just contracted out. They put out a contract and anyone could bid for this. And so really the state role was quite minimal. What you're saying is that this is, okay, the ships were not owned directly by the state, but it's very heavily directed by the Roman state.
Yeah, and I don't want to over-egg the pudding, and I will say that, yes, certainly there are a great number of aspects of this system and other redistributive systems in the Roman Empire that kind of have private public. I mean, these distinctions don't mean as much in the Roman Empire, but are sort of, yeah, there are contracts, there are private, like not a lot of these people are like state employees. It's not quite that way of doing things. But at every stage of the process, there is a certain level of state involvement. And it's not simply kind of the referee type thing, right? This is the state really intervening in a direct way to funnel resources into particular modes of consumption. And that, of course, creates a variety of distortions in markets, and it makes markets very difficult, have a bit more of a difficult time in the Roman Empire than we might think. I mean, it's a meaningless counterfactual, but had the Roman state left a little bit more alone and sort of allowed more of a market for grain, I don't know that they would have seen some of the problems that they ended up seeing in kind of the middle to late second century and then onward.
Yeah. And do we have any evidence for this sort of system being emulated in other sort of provincial cities rather than just the imperial capital? Or as far as we can tell, is it just something that operates in Rome and then later Constantinople?
Yeah, so great question. This gets into that kind of franchising issue. So the Annona itself is almost a one of a kind situation. No other city is quite capable of using such bulk economies of scale to create a system like this. However, what we do know are a few things. One is that once Rome, if it was a particularly good year, say in Egypt, and there was leftover grain in Egypt, other cities were more than welcome to purchase that grain. And many of the leaders of those cities, whether they were client kings or senates modeled after the Roman Senate or city councils, could distribute that grain. And indeed, many of them did. And so you do see smaller scale versions of redistributive kind of institutions and programs in the Roman Empire. But the other thing that we see too, there are private, what we might call private, anachronistically, private forms of kind of welfare, or again, maybe there's a more precise word, redistributions of resources. So local elites will either just on their own create endowment funds or programs for the regular purchase of grain and then the resale of grain. But we also see local elites kind of semi-voluntarily feeding the Roman military. So there is an inscription that I mentioned in the book that we find in Ephesus, where a fairly well-off elite in Ephesus pays for about 5 months worth of grain for the Roman army as it marches through that city, as it's returning from a war with Parthia that concludes in around 165, 166. So there were examples of this too, where we see both sort of city governments and then just very wealthy individuals also engaging in these redistributive schemes.
Oh, that's really interesting. And one of the things that this also brings up is that the fact that the rural areas of the Roman Empire are able to generate this surplus, this sort of level of surplus, to supply such high relatively high levels of urbanization compared to, say, medieval Europe or you know, many areas right up until the 18th or 19th century. Is this evidence that Roman agriculture is just really productive, or is it that the Roman state is just much better at extracting surplus than later states are?
Or is that that's a great question, and I'm probably going to give a little bit more of a speculative answer. So we do see, certainly in the High Roman Empire, 1st and 2nd centuries AD, there are quite a few loopholes in the tax system. And by tax system, I don't mean just money taxes. I also mean in-kind taxes, expropriations of actual foodstuffs, grain, cereals, wine, etc. there are a lot of loopholes in that system. So I don't want to say that the Roman state is sort of ruthlessly efficient. They get much better at it in the kind of fourth century and quite ruthless at, you know, every parcel of land needs to make sure, we need to make sure that every parcel of land is taxed. But Roman agriculture is reasonably productive because in part, I think of just factors that have nothing to do with the Roman economic system. There is just a fairly decent period climatologically during the kind of late Republic and early Empire, such that the weather is generally more conducive to cereal crop growth than it is a little bit later. But also the types of grain that the Romans are growing are quite diverse, and so they're pretty hardy. They can withstand fluctuations in the climate, periods of drought, periods of intense heat, in ways which sort of modern grain could not. So this was very useful for the Romans, but it's probably just a combination of a variety of factors that enable the Roman state to acquire so much grain to feed these urbanites.
Okay, would we not also expect, even if we do acknowledge that the Roman Empire is quite extractive and isn't particularly interested in economic development, or don't even think in those terms per se, mm-hmm. wouldn't the simple fact that you have by the first century AD the whole of the Mediterranean under the control of a single political authority, and you have free trade essentially in this region, wouldn't you expect to get at least a bit of, you know, Smithian growth in that it would allow different regions to specialize more in different types of agriculture? Do we see any evidence of that in, say, the first or second century?
Absolutely. And yeah, and again, I don't want to paint too simplistic of a picture. There is good evidence for specialization in the Roman Empire, for sure. When we're talking about, I mean, everything from particular types of goods to even the vessels that carry those goods. Often, you know, there are certain parts of the Roman Empire that get very good at producing particular types of things. So we do see evidence of specialization and some of these factors that would form the kind of ingredients that we would want to see in a Smithian, you know, economy that actually experiences real per capita growth. And yet for some bizarre, now it's hard to measure growth in the pre-industrial world. So obviously this is a controversial and sort of difficult question to answer with firmness. If there is some Smithian growth in the Roman economy, which I accept that this is a possibility for sure for the reasons that we're talking about, it does not last very long, and it would go away fairly quickly. So it is possible. I don't want to discount the possibility that we see what it seems like we see, specialization and so on and so forth. But we also see pretty strong evidence institutionally that the Roman state was such a distortive entity that markets just, in my opinion, would have struggled to really really grow in ways in which we can see sort of a sustained, again, sort of a sustained new economic threshold in the Roman Empire. Just the Roman state is too big, it's too bulky, it's too involved. The productivity is okay in the countryside, but nowhere it's taxed away very, very quickly. So it just seems to me that it just doesn't quite make it. You need a lot of different things to happen in order to have real per capita economic growth. And I'm just not sure that the Roman economy is able to quite get there.
In your opinion, does slavery play any sort of significant role in this? Because there's a bit of a, you know, perhaps the straw man version of this telling is that, Well, the Romans never could have had an industrial revolution because they had loads of slaves, and that meant labor was always cheaper than investing in capital. Therefore, you don't get growth. Now, that's obviously pushing it a bit far. But do you think there is a role in which slavery also distorts the Roman economy in unusual ways?
Absolutely, for a couple of reasons. I think the version that you, the story that you just told is, as you rightly say, a little bit oversimplified, but there is some truth to that, certainly. Slave labor in the Roman Empire is predominant. I mean, we don't know the numbers of slaves, but probably 20-30% of the Roman Empire's workforce is enslaved in some way, and this creates the economics that you just described. But also there is the matter of status as well, and that is that the Romans, slavery is not just an economic issue for the Romans. It is a marker of status, and bizarrely enough, is a marker of civilization. The fact that the Romans are able to capture foreign peoples, put them to work for them and to dominate them. This is something that makes it very, very difficult for the Romans to let go of slavery at the same time. And so this issue is there as well. So I do think the slavery issue matters. And Roman wage laborers are looked down upon. So even though I think it's far more efficient to have wage laborers, contract laborers, the way that we see estate owners thinking about their employees seems to be that they would rather have people that are kind of in the household, and slaves would be in the household. There's bizarrely enough, they trust slaves more in many ways than they do wage labor. So they're the kind of these cultural disincentives to really open up a labor, kind of a free labor economy. And I think this also could affect the way the sort of the potential of the Roman economy for growth.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. I think Deirdre McCloskey has made a similar point about the upper end of Roman society, that the Roman elite seems to have lacked a sort of bourgeois culture that later develops, where in Rome, the whole point of making money is to stop making money, is to retire from business and, you know, live a life of leisure where you read, you know, Homer and that sort of thing, rather than to kind of reinvest, and certainly rather than stay in trade, which is very much, very much looked down on, I think, by comparison to agriculture, let's say. Okay, so we've kind of set the scene in many ways for what the Roman economy is like on the cusp of the Antonine Plague, which hits Rome in the 160s AD. First question, which is, I know, an unfair one. What was the Antonine Plague?
you rightly characterized that question as unfair because, you've read the book. After writing this entire book on the Antonine Plague, and this may be frustrating for some readers, I still feel like I cannot say that we know what this disease must be. Here's what we know. It's a deadly disease. It is a highly transmissible disease, and it has some pretty nasty symptoms. Everything, a fever, ulcers in the throat, bloody, I mean, how, I don't know how gruesome you want me to be, but, you know, bloody stool, pustular rash, and death for many that were unfortunate enough to contract this disease. So it is something nasty. Unfortunately, our descriptions of the disease are such that we just simply do not have what it takes to make a diagnosis, and we do not have the genetic evidence that would allow us to firmly identify the pathogen behind this disease. It looks to me, and I'm, you know, a bit of an amateur when it comes to diagnosing disease. I don't have a medical doctorate or anything like that. But it does seem to me something like a kind of pox virus of some kind. But that's, I don't want to go too far because we're starting, I would be getting out of my lane at that point. But it is a nasty, deadly disease.
Yeah. It wasn't traditionally the notion that it was smallpox. But now, due to DNA sequencing, we probably think that, you know, the modern smallpox, if you like, is probably only about 500 years old. And so it's maybe something related, but not that exactly.
That's right, Daniel. As is often the case with these ancient puzzles, we're better at figuring out what something was not rather than what it was. And I think smallpox, at least modern smallpox, we now have very robust genetic evidence. This is not an ancient disease. The disease is about 500 years old or thereabouts. So it cannot have been modern smallpox, which in some sense is unfortunate because we had some very good modeling that has been done on smallpox, which has been applied to the ancient world. And now we kind of have to chuck a little bit of that out and start from scratch. And so Pax Romana tries to build on at least what we can know without sort of being overly speculative and trying to give a diagnosis when we don't have the evidence to do so.
Yeah. And so you talk quite a lot in the book about how the economic context in which existed in Rome in the mid-second century facilitated the spread of this disease, whatever it ultimately was. Could you go into a bit of detail on that?
Yeah.
How did Rome help it spread?
Yeah, so it's partly the Roman economy, and it's partly the kind of naked coercive aspect of the Roman state in terms of its military. So for the Roman economy, at this time, in kind of the 150s, 160s AD, I'm not sure that there was another time in pre-industrial history when the Eurasian landmass was as economically integrated as it was at this point. And not just because of state connectivity. I really do think, with the Red Sea and Indian Ocean trade networks that have developed and are quite robust at this time, with the budding of the Silk Road overland trade networks, and with reasonably good conditions, diplomatic conditions between the various Eurasian empires, this is a great opportunity, a great time to be a trader, a merchant, especially in luxury goods that tend to be actually worth the investment of putting in the investment to actually make them cross over such vast distances. And so we have ships from Alexandria finding their way from Berenike, Egypt, finding their way all the way into the Han Empire in China. Within the Roman Empire alone, I mean, moving across the Mediterranean has really never been easier. And so suddenly, all of these populations that have had very little contact with each other prior and have kind of developed their own disease profiles and immunity profiles are coming into contact in ways that they had not before. And so this, of course, facilitates the spread of contagion. But also, the Roman state is at its almost its greatest extent. It had reached that under Trajan in 117 AD, but there were still, I mean, under Marcus Aurelius and his co-emperor Lucius Verus in the 160s, the Romans launch a major invasion into the Parthian Empire, into Persia, and are able to march tens of thousands of soldiers deep into Mesopotamia and besiege cities that are also highly populated, cities of 100, 200, 300,000 people. And again, this also facilitates the spread of diseases, especially those that are dependent upon high-density populations. You have a lot of soldiers in a siege, in a city that is itself highly populous for, you know, over the course of a winter, the period of time in which many diseases are at their strongest. And then those same soldiers march back into the Roman Empire as they return to their bases throughout Europe. This is a perfect storm for a novel disease to find its way across the Eurasian landmass.
Yeah. And the fact that you have such high urbanization rates seems to aid the spreading of disease. I think it's, you know, another point that you hammer home on quite a few times is that cities in most of the world before the Industrial Revolution, and even in some cases a little bit after that, are basically demographic sinks. A city before the, say, 1850s pretty much always needs a constant supply of in-migration because they're such unhealthy places to live that they sort of need to be constantly topped up with people.
That's right. Go ahead. Oh, sure. And just to add to that very briefly, even Rome itself, the capital of the empire, with its aqueducts and its baths and its sewers, these are not institutions that necessarily make the city a cleaner place. I mean, the Roman baths are basically urban ponds in which the water just kind of sits in its tepid state, collecting every bit of dirt and feces and grime that is brought in and then, you know, is just consistently recycled. So in addition to what you're saying about the cities being demographic sinks, they are just disgusting also. They are just jungles for diseases. And so they're conducive to disease spread because of the populations and because of the conditions. And then, as you mentioned, right, with the population sink, the migration that is necessary to sustain the population levels continually brings in not only new diseases with these people that come in, but brings in people that have not faced the onslaught of diseases that are already in the city. So the Roman Empire was a kind of sitting duck for some kind of major pandemic event.
Yeah. Well, your book is the only book on the ancient world I've ever read that has described Rome as a shithole. Using exactly that words and having read the chapter on Roman baths, I'm very sympathetic to that. Are there any sort of long-term economic impact of this plague as far as we can tell, or is it just a sort of short, sharp hit and then the empire sort of recovers from it?
Yeah, this is a question of debate among scholars. I think the long-term effects are both kind of practical, but also, I guess we might even call them spiritual. So on the one hand, however many people died, and we don't really know how many, I'm a bit of a minimalist, actually. I tend to be on the side of scholars that do not see the actual death toll from the plague being as high as others. And that's because, despite the fact that this disease goes just about everywhere in the Roman Empire, there are only about 20% of the population that live in cities. We don't have really any evidence that the disease spreads into the countryside. And so that just limits how many people are going to die. But nevertheless, the Roman economy is, as we talked about in the beginning of the interview, a lot more fragile than we might have initially thought. And so even a 5% mortality rate is going to have significant effects on agricultural production as field workers die, on the production of metals as mine workers die, and quarries as quarry workers die. So, and soldiers, this is probably really where we see the most practical effects. Rome, when the plague hits, the Roman Empire is about to launch a war on its northern border with several different Germanic tribes. And everybody thinks that this is going to be just a cakewalk. This is not going to be a challenging war. And because in part of this plague devastating the soldiers and then the finances of the empire by means of slowing down mine production, metal production, so on and so forth, it just prolongs this war about a decade. And as a result, there are desertions from the army, which cause other knock-on effects. So yes, there are pretty significant economic effects, despite the fact that the death toll may have been as low as or even lower than 5%. Then there are the kind of spiritual effects, which I'll talk about just briefly. This is the first time, as far as I can tell, any disease was perceived as being able to infect anyone, anywhere. Prior to this pandemic, everybody thought of diseases as a local phenomenon. They affected a city. They might affect a region, but they were not everywhere. And so suddenly people begin to extend their way of thinking into this kind of global way of thinking. Oh my goodness, diseases can come everywhere. And that means the gods can be angry with an entire empire. That means we need to find solutions and we need to worship the gods the same way or with sufficient enthusiasm. And that means all of us in the entire empire, we can't have a bunch of religious diversity anymore. We can't have these crazy Christians, for example, running around not worshiping the Roman gods. So there are other kind of spiritual, cultural consequences that we see, I think, rearing their head later on as well.
Yeah, you in the book, you have a whole chapter titled The Age of Angst, which I think gets across this feeling quite well. Just as a final question, throughout the book and throughout this conversation, we've sort of been talking about the limits of the evidence that we have when talking about the Roman economy or the impact of the Antonine Plague on it. What would be your sort of dream bit of evidence, your dream kind of source that might theoretically exist that you would love to see, you know, being dug up from an Egyptian rubbish heap or whatever, that you think would really help us understand the Roman economy a bit more?
If you wow. Peace. That is a great question. And it's such a good question that it has even never occurred to me. And maybe that's because I've become such a pessimist in all of my years studying this topic. And I just assume that we're never going to get anything new. So let me answer this a few different ways. One thing that would be useful, and just thinking about the narrow view of the Antonine Plague, you asked about the Roman economy, but just with the Antonine Plague, I'd love to have some genetic confirmation of what the disease was, because we'd be able to create some models like what we had when we thought that it was smallpox, which would give us a better sense not only of how the disease acted, but I think we could use the spread of a disease that was known and its known effects that we could then model if we knew what it was to better understand the Roman economy. Like if we have a disease that we know acts a certain way when population densities reach a certain point or when urbanization rates reach a certain point, broadly speaking, we could learn a lot more about the makeup and the nature of the Roman economy. So that would be one piece of evidence that I think would have these knock-on effects of utility in the study of the ancient Roman economy. But I'm also just interested in what people think. So while I'm tempted to say some kind of budget document or some kind of document that would give me a sense of like, inputs and outputs and you know, how much is being spent on the military or how much is being spent on that, I really actually would just love to really have a good answer to the question as to how much these people really thought kind of entrepreneurially. So there's this question, which you touched on earlier in the interview, to what extent was there a kind of bourgeois class? To what extent was there this entrepreneurial group of middlemen? And this has long been debated among historians, and it would be useful to find some kind of evidence that could firmly settle that question, not because it would necessarily tell us about numbers or GDP, but it would give us a sense of what humanity was like in the Roman Empire. Like, to what extent were they like us? To what extent is capitalism a flash in the pan thing that we're just enjoying right now? Or to what extent were the kind of thought processes that we see in the modern world, which have built a beautiful decentralized society, to what extent were those thought processes in operation in the ancient world? So some kind of document that would give us that kind of insight, I would love that.
Yeah, no, that I think that would be really interesting as well. I suppose these sort of middlemen aren't generally the sort of people who write history in the Roman period anyway. But you know, they keep digging up papyrus in bits of the Middle East, so you never know. Let's hope. Well, thank you for coming on. I think it's been a really interesting conversation. For the audience, if you have found this interesting, which if you've stuck around for this long, you hopefully have, I would really recommend you, recommend you buy or at least have a look at Pax Romana, which is available in all good book shops now. Pox Romana. Pax Romana is Colin's podcast, which is also excellent, so you might want to consider subscribing to that. While you're on the topic of subscribing to things, you might also want to subscribe to the IEA's YouTube channel for more interviews, discussions, and debates on similar topics, which are just as interesting as this conversation.